This is Block by Block, a community news program from WPPM LP 106.5 FM, where we explore issues affecting the Philadelphia area with news reports from members of the community. I'm Sultan Smalley.
And I'm Jennifer Robnett. In the next half hour, we'll hear stories from our community news reporters about a group that provides free tampons, pads, and other menstrual products for students at the Community College of Philadelphia, and an aspect of Philadelphia's history that you don't often hear about, the role the city played in America's vegetarian and vegan movements.
But first, Philadelphia is known for its historic sites like Independence Hall, the Liberty Bell, and the Betsy Ross House. But not all of the city's historic places are located in Center City. The Johnson House is a National Historic Landmark and Museum in Germantown that was once a station in the Underground Railroad. Block by Block reporter Marian McVare studies American history, and she recently rode her bike from West Philly to Germantown to take a tour of Johnson House.
When I biked up to Germantown, I got lost. It doesn't happen that much in Philadelphia, because usually I just have to follow the grid structure of a city. But in Germantown, streets are narrow, hills are steep, and it resembles a canvas much more than a grid. It was my first time in this part of the city. Before moving to Philadelphia about 4 months ago, I had never heard of the Johnson House. But as I started looking into the history of that city that I just moved in, I found out about this place and about the Underground Railroad, that secret network which helped enslaved African Americans to escape to freedom. I knew Philadelphia was in a northern state, and I wasn't sure I understood how it connected to the Underground Railroad, which I mostly associated with the South. So I decided to find out. I took a long bike ride along the Schuylkill, and I arrived to a nice brick house where I knocked on the door and stepped in. There, I met Connie, the executive director, and Bunny, the archivist. Connie took me on a tour of the house and told me about the people the Johnson House is named for.
Jeanette Roland Johnson was what was called a Hicksite Quaker, which are progressive Quakers. So when she married Samuel Johnson, she bought that progressive thought. So it was their religious belief, basically, that is, God did not intend for one man to enslave another man. And so they struggled to make that point. And they did it at great risk because it was illegal to do what they were doing.
Our first stop was the living room, where there were a lot of different objects from the past and the present, from Bibles to quilts made in 2014 alongside maps. Connie told me about one that represented the slave trade, and one which showed the routes taken to escape slavery in the United States.
There's a reason why the slave trade began, and that is the industry, the money that would be made. It's important that when you come through this house, that you learn about why. Not that it happened, but why it happened and why the struggle was so hard, because it was an economic struggle.
So right here, slave states, right there, free states, right? Mm-hmm. And Philadelphia is here in a free state. So what was the role of this house in the Underground Railroad?
The word was, if you reached Philadelphia, you made it. But if you are Black and you were enslaved, or you were Black and you were free, who knew that you were by looking at you? In Philadelphia, there were actually many of the houses that exist up here now that had slaves. There were manumission papers that you may have had. The atmosphere politically was, how do I know that's real? Mm-hmm. Who gave you that? You stole it, if there was a conversation. And there were slave catchers. So there was incentive.
As we walked from room to room in the house, Connie told me a lot of stories about the Johnson family.
And you know, the Johnsons were like, they were loyal people. They were having a meeting, an abolitionist meeting here, and someone who was in the house was enslaved. And there was a knock on the door. This door. It was the sheriff. And she got up, she took the enslaved people that were here, while the folks that were here gathered everything together and got ready to open up the door, and she rushed them upstairs. The back garret is on the third floor. It's still standing, and that's where enslaved Africans stayed while they were here. See the hatch in the roof? The family says that it was used for escape during close calls. So when that sheriff knocked on that door and she led them up here, they laid out on the ledge on the outside of the roof. So when Mrs. Johnson, when the sheriff, you know, said to her, "Are you have people that are here that are enslaved? You know, I mean, this is a law." And she said, "No, sir. There is no slaves in this house." And they weren't, because they were on the roof outside.
As we continued to tour the house, we stopped in a dining room where documents belonging to an all-white women's club were exhibited. Can you explain to me why they chose to still display these documents, despite their controversial nature, knowing that this is a historic site honoring an important part of Black American history?
As an organization, we decided that in recognizing the advocacy work that the Johnsons did, it was important for us to say they had their place in this building, because they made sure that this building stayed maintained. So if you bought it in 1919 and you didn't leave until the 80s, late 80s, you stored it, this house, for a long time. We're grateful for that. And so we recognize the work that they did, including immunizing children, educating children in the community, and providing them with some entertainment and healthcare services.
The Johnson House has always been rooted in the Germantown community. It was always part of a neighborhood and concerned with the people surrounding it.
We created the Center for Social Advocacy based on that history of the Johnsons. I mean, they weren't just involved in the struggle for freedom. They were aware of the support that those who were enslaved needed. They were involved with helping women, helping men, providing education for men because they weren't able to be educated. The full history of this house hadn't been told, unless you talk about that part of it as well. And we wanted to use that as a way to say to the community, this is what happened here. It's not just a one and done, which was very important, a struggle for freedom, but they believed so much in what they were doing. They were leaders in other areas as well. We have our summer program, our Underground Railroad and Ashe Cultural Club summer camp for 5 weeks for kids. They learn about Africa. They don't start here in this house. They start in Africa. So they learn about that, because what we want to do is teach them that you don't have to say you don't have a history because your history hasn't been told fully. And this is the history that we want you to learn about, so that you can use it in a way that empowers you and empowers your understanding of your beginnings. We also have done work to address the issue of mass incarceration.
In choosing how to curate this site, Bonnie, Kani, and everyone who works there makes a statement. The Johnson House has a great amount of archives in its possession, but their action are also very much anchored in the present time.
We are a small historic site. There was a deliberate process to decide that this site would be community owned. So everything that we do, we have to fundraise in order for us to maintain the site and keep it open. And folks assume that because we are historic and we're designated, that that means that the government takes care of us, and it doesn't. So that's a misperception. And some things we have to say no to because they want what we can't provide, because we just don't have the capacity to always do it. Our capacity, we're choosing to use it wisely. We want to promote the history of the site. Early literacy is important for us. The issues, the social issues that impact the community are important to us.
As I biked back to West Philadelphia and its familiar grid structure, I understood that in this house, history is a statement grounded in the present and the community surrounding it.
You can find out more about Johnson House and its workshops and other programs by visiting its website at johnsonhouse.org.
A club at the Community College of Philadelphia is providing free menstrual and hygiene products for students, including tampons, pads, condoms, and deodorant. The Period Poverty Project also held its first support group yesterday and plans to meet biweekly to discuss reproductive health and gender equity. My co-host, Sultan Smalley, recently spoke with three leaders of the Period Poverty Project to find out what motivates them.
Hi, my name is Angie. I'm currently a sophomore business student at the Community College of Philadelphia, and I'm also the founder of the Period Poverty Project.
My name is Brian. I'm a sophomore liberal arts student at the Community College of Philadelphia, and I am the vice president of the Period Poverty Project.
My name is Asada Ibrahim. I'm a chem student, and I'm the NERC president of the Period Poverty Project.
First things first, can you tell our listeners what the Period Poverty Project is?
First of all, it's a movement. As it says in the name, it is a project that we began here at the Community College of Philadelphia because we recognize there was a lack of period products on campus.
I think another important thing about this project is that we shed light on periods, and it's not a taboo topic to talk about, and also just building that community and making sure that it's accessible to students, because in reality, by the name, it's a period poverty project, and some people just can't afford those products, and you can't afford it when you need it. So what are you supposed to do?
You sort of touched on it a little bit already, but can you just tell me what sort of encouraged you to start this club?
I think experiencing period poverty growing up, and something that really like gave me a helping hand was going to Central High School and seeing that they had like a period group, and they always had like tampons, pads, liners. And I just felt so, you know, safe there. And I felt like every time I had a pad, it was like almost like a hug from them. I'm like, it's really something that every woman, gender nonconforming individual that has a period should have. And I just wanted to give back to my new community because, you know, I knew I was going to be here for 2 years and I wanted to start something that would make a lasting impact.
Brian, you spoke about gender equity a little bit. So can you tell me what that means to you?
There's this concept, I think, in a lot of dynamics with marginalized groups of the marginalized person having more things in their way at all times, not just in terms of what they want to achieve, but just moving through life. There's things that weigh on them that don't weigh on other people, things they have to consider that other people don't have to consider. And it's just sort of this constant pressure. And I think one of those things for people who have periods is acquiring the products they need consistently, regularly. And I think another aspect of it is a lot of the time we associate poverty with total destitution, but even people who have managed to scrape by and fit period products into their budget benefit from being able to put that money elsewhere, whether it's a small relief or a huge one. So I think what goes into gender equity is beyond just like this level playing field concept, and it's about freeing up the shoulders of people facing these issues, so letting them like breathe again and be able to devote their time and attention to the things that matter to them as individuals, not to the things that are thrust upon them as a group.
Although the project is centered around period poverty, it doesn't also have to apply to that, because sometimes you could just be put in a situation where you just get your period and you need a pad or a tampon and you just don't have one. And if you're on campus, maybe you don't have time to go buy one, or you just don't have the money on you at the moment. Or if we're looking at it at a different aspect, maybe you're in high school, you can't just leave school and go get a pad or a tampon. You're just kind of stuck in this predicament.
I think something else we've been doing recently to address this has been bringing this to a lot of different groups' attention on campus, one of them being the Center for Male Engagement. We're thinking about doing workshops with them surrounding periods, the stigma surrounding it, and how to go breaking that, and how they should go to women or menstruators in general, and how they should support menstruators in general. So yeah, we're doing a lot of work with that, not just providing the products, but also thinking about the educational aspect of it as well.
What does PPP have planned for the future?
We're happy to say our vending machine is coming in soon. We are ideating a support group that will talk about a variety of topics, being an opportunity for people to just come in, unwind, bring up issues that they may want addressed, so that, you know, PPP can deal with what the people need them to deal with, be it reproductive health products or beyond.
PPP for us is not just a project, it's also a movement. So we also want to work on taking this project with us wherever we end up moving after CCP when we move on to university, so expanding it to other places that might need it as well.
How can those who want to support the Period Poverty Project help out?
Well, if you're a guy, you can, or someone who doesn't have periods and who might have grown up knowing nothing about them, you can start by throwing your internalized stigma away and recognizing that you too can play a part. You can support what we're doing. You can get educated. You can get involved.
You can also donate through our Amazon wish list. We also have donation drop-off locations. We have one at Northeast, and we have some locations at main campus as well.
And is there any last thoughts that you'd like to say?
I'm a big supporter of like reproductive freedom, and I hope whoever's listening like considers doing more research or like supporting reproductive freedoms through this work or other works throughout the city of Philadelphia. And yeah, I'm just super grateful to be surrounded by a lot of advocates, and it's awesome being an advocate myself.
You probably know that Philadelphia is the home of the cheesesteak, but did you know that it is also home to a thriving vegan culture? Block by Block reporter Julia Lowe visited the American Vegan Center in Old City to find out how vegan and vegetarian eating is a part of Philly's history.
Philadelphia is not only the birthplace of the American Revolution, it's also where a different kind of American Revolution began, one to avoid eating animals. The vegan diet has its place in Philadelphia's history going as far back as colonial times and remains a prominent eating culture in the city still today. Philly has a robust vegan dining scene with more than 50 vegan and vegetarian restaurants in the city, including several which have even received awards from omnivorous food critics. Philadelphia regularly ranks in the top 10 U.S. cities for vegans and vegetarians, according to publications like Veg Out magazine. Besides this range of restaurant options, the city is also home to the American Vegan Center, which offers resources and information for vegan and vegetarian eating in the region.
My name is Vance Lemkool. I'm the director here at the American Vegan Center in Old City, right across from Christ Church, 17 North 2nd.
Since opening in late 2021, the American Vegan Center has offered programming for those with an interest in veganism. They've hosted cooking classes, open mic nights, trivia nights, and activist networking meetings. The center also sells merchandise such as t-shirts, postcards, books, and of course, some vegan food and snacks. But they don't just cater to vegans, they try to meet folks wherever they are. If they come in with no interest in veganism, Vance hopes that they leave with just a little bit more interest in it, especially because it's Philly history.
Philadelphia is inarguably the city that launched the U.S. vegetarian movement. The people who started the American Vegetarian Society first arrived here and first set up shop just about 100 feet in back of where the American Vegan Center is.
That group was the Bible Christians, who came from England and established their headquarters in 1817 on the alley where modern-day Church Street sits today. And they weren't the only vegetarian activists in the city's history. Vance regularly gives tours in Old City, taking visitors to sites where vegan and vegetarian pioneers lived and worked. He took me on a special version of his Veg History Tour. Veg, because the word vegan didn't emerge until 1944, to explain just how far back meatless diets in Philadelphia really go.
So right here at 2nd and Market, this is where our first vegetarian pioneer stopped upon arriving in Philadelphia to buy vegetarian food. This was a man by the name of Benjamin Franklin. He's the only household name on our tour, and he is somebody who's kind of the least vegetarian of all. He went vegetarian as a teenager up in Boston, where he was indentured to his brother as a printer, and he found that if he had his brother give him the money that his brother would spend to feed him, Benjamin Franklin could eat vegetarian and save money and buy books with the rest. So he did that. Then he broke the indenture, ran away from his brother, hitchhiked down to Philadelphia on a series of boats.
As the story goes, Franklin did end up eating fish on his way here. But when he arrived in Philadelphia, he again went vegetarian and unvegetarian several more times. But Vance tells me that Ben Franklin always saw it more as a dietary experiment conducted on himself rather than a permanent lifestyle. However,
one thing that Benjamin Franklin definitely did, which is incontrovertible, is he is the first person to try to introduce tofu into the American colonies. And here, for our people listening on audio, I am now displaying a cartoon caricature of Benjamin Franklin holding out a plate of tofu.
Now, Vance is taking creative license here. Franklin didn't literally walk around Market Street with tofu in hand. But in 1770, Franklin was in London at a diplomatic function with a Chinese delegation present, where he did indeed eat tofu. He was amazed by the creation, which he referred to as a cheese made from plants. He even attempted to have soybeans grown for tofu production in Philadelphia, but there's no record of it going anywhere. While Benjamin Franklin's vegetarianism was somewhat casual, another Benjamin and a friend of Franklin's, Benjamin Lay, was motivated by moral conviction. A practicing Quaker, Lay called for the freedom of animals and, more importantly, the abolition of slavery.
His abolitionism and his vegetarianism were part of one basic concept for Benjamin Lay. He really took seriously this concept, God's mercy must be extended to all creatures, which many Quakers would say, meaning all humans. But Benjamin Lay was like, well, why stop there? It should be all sentient beings. So he wouldn't eat meat, he wouldn't wear wool, he wouldn't wear leather. He actually pretty much invented guerrilla street theater in North America with a series of stunts that he would do to shock the Quakers out of their complacency. Again, this is another cartoon selection that we're looking at here where there was a snowdrift next to the meeting house. Benjamin Lay is standing next to the front door with his naked foot stuck in the snow. And as the rich Quakers would come in, they would say, Benjamin, get your foot out of the snow. You're going to catch your death of cold. And he would say, oh, I see. You have so much compassion for my well-being while your slaves are working in the fields all winter long without adequate clothing.
Although Benjamin Lay's antics were considered a bit too radical for his time, he did influence a few notable Quakers to join his cause, including one Anthony Benezet. With three other followers of Benjamin Lay's, Benezet was able to get a church rule changed, disowning Quakers who bought or sold slaves. And this wasn't his only impact. We stopped to read a historical marker about Benezet's influence on the anti-slavery movement, which sits at 4th and Chestnut.
I gotta stop myself talking about Benezet because I'll just go on for hours on end. But he really was an amazing person. And again, the reason that this is all relevant for him is, like Benjamin Lay, he really saw the human oppression of humans and the human oppression of animals as part of one big problem. So his biographer, Maurice Jackson, says Benezet went vegetarian because he did not want to eat anything that might be associated with slave labor. People now believe that Ben Franklin's longtime association with Anthony Benezet and Benjamin Lay is what led him to, at the end of his life, cease being a slaveholder and become an abolitionist. And Ben Franklin actually became the president of the Pennsylvania Abolition Society that Benezet had co-founded.
After our tour, my discussion with Vance about the veg movement's past, present, and future continues back at the American Vegan Center. He explains that it's important to help people understand the long history of vegan and vegetarian movements in the country, because many people assume it's some kind of recent fad.
One of the things that the general public thinks about vegan and vegetarian food and vegans and vegetarians is that they are a type of person, a type of motivation that has just arisen relatively recently. A lot of people think, oh, vegan, that probably goes back to the 1960s. Vegetarian, who knows? Maybe they've been vegetarians, you know, in the early 20th century. Whereas, in fact, as the Veg History Tour tries to underscore, these ideas have been fundamental to Western civilization since we started recording history.
Given the veg movement's long-standing history and presence in Philadelphia, it's safe to say the American Vegan Center and its advocates are here to stay. And Philadelphia is still making vegan history many years later. Some of the city's more recent vegan pioneers have been innovative in creating plant-based substitutes for meat-based products.
I like to mention Alphonse Austin. She ran Basic for Vegetarian in the Reading Terminal Market for 30 years, which was essentially a vegetarian and then vegan deli, which now we have Love in the Reading Terminal Market, which has a big sign that says vegan deli. That's great. Alphonse really did blaze a trail there in getting Philadelphia diners used to this concept that if you like a particular kind of food that's animal-based, you can just have it plant-based, and she could make it so that, you know, you didn't feel like you were losing anything. So there's obviously, it's like the stock market, you know, it goes up and down, but over the long term, it's going up. As in my opinion, we'll see if that bears out over the next 5 to 10 years, but that is the way that I'm seeing it.
So when you're at the grocery store this week or when you gather around the Thanksgiving table, remember the pioneers who, even almost 250 years ago, were challenging traditions with what they chose not to eat. The American Vegan Center is open Wednesday through Sunday, except for Thanksgiving Day and Black Friday, and Vance offers veg history walking tours on Saturdays and Sundays at noon.
The American Vegan Society is hosting free 5-minute cooking demos at its Old City location on Friday, December 6th from 6 to 8 o'clock as part of a First Friday event. You can find more information at AmericanVegan.org.
Today is Transgender Day of Remembrance, also known as TDOR. It's a day to remember transgender people who have lost their lives to violence. Philadelphia's William Way LGBT Community Center is hosting a Trans Wellness and Remembrance event today at the University of Pennsylvania's LGBT Center in West Philly, with programming scheduled through 8 o'clock this evening. In our next story, which was originally broadcast in 2022, Block by Block's Brad Linder spoke with a leader in Philadelphia's trans community about the significance of TDOR.
My name is AJ Scruggs. My pronouns are he, him, they, them, and king. And I am a Black trans man. I'm the executive director and founder of Visible Truth 365. We connect Black trans folks to growth opportunities that are spiritual, personal, or professional. TDOR was actually started as a way to remember those we've lost through violence. Trans women of color experience so much hatred, discrimination, and even death just for existing. This time is to remember that you can be that change. You can be that difference in that trans person's life, even if you just intervene from somebody harassing them. We shouldn't have to remember the fallen because nobody is willing to stand up. There is a level of lack of knowledge about our community. So we kind of use this day and this week, actually, for the trans week of what we like to call resilience, to just make sure that folks are aware that, you know, trans folks are being harmed and murdered, discriminated against, bullied as a whole community. Resilience is existing when people say you shouldn't. We have fought back. We have continuously showed up. We have so many trans leaders whose stories, their lives of getting to the point where they are, you know, in the Office of LGBTQ Affairs and at the ACLU. So that's resilience in itself. It's such an important day within the community to recognize that while we have come a long way, there's still a lot of work to do as community members, as trans people, as policymakers and decision makers. We have a long, long road ahead in order to get to the point where that day will literally be to remember those that we have lost, but it won't be due to trans violence. We want to be able to switch that narrative of what that remembrance is actually remembering.
Block by Block is produced by Lisa Barnes, Julia Lowe, Marian McVair, Sherry Pennington, Natalie Thomas, K. Michelle Watson, and us,
Jennifer Robnett,
and Sultan Smalley. Lisa Barnes is our board operator tonight.
Brad Linder is Radio News Managing Editor for WPPM. Pete Alou is Radio Operations Manager. And Allison Durham is WPPM's Radio Program Manager.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with a new episode of Block by Block, featuring more stories about issues affecting life in the Philly region. And you can find past episodes of the show on PhillyCam's SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you find your podcasts.
Thanks for listening.